think if you want to help and be of service to people, you can't be static yourself. You have to continue to grow. You have to continue to challenge.
It's fun.
Before we get going with today's firecracker of a guest, a quick housekeeping note. A lot of you have shared that you love the podcast, so I ask that you hop on Apple Podcasts or iTunes to subscribe and rate I Digress Podcast. Your support is humbling, and this simple step would really help. All right, let's do this. Welcome to episode 11 of I Digress Podcast. I'm Arul Chanel. I'm very excited about today's guest. The dude is a ball of positive energy and hustle. I met Mark Hands through Instagram when he reached out to me after I liked a couple of his pictures he posted while wearing big truck hats. Pretty random, right? So I asked him to tell me more. He directed me to his website, and then after doing a little bit more of a background check, I knew I had to have this guy on ASAP. And by the way, there's this one little nugget that I'm not telling you about Mark's story that is fucking awesome. So here we are. Are you ready? So who is Mark Hands?
My first response is I'm just Mark, right? I kind of do take for granted kind of all my life experiences and that have kind of built me into the person I am today and the person that I'm continuing to grow into. But I think the best way to succinctly answer who is Mark Hands, you put family, cultural diversity, entrepreneurship, being down to earth, helping other people, you put that shit in a blender and then you add some like punk rock, skateboard, Grateful Dead, you hit blend and like that's the Mark Hands shake.
Sounds more like an energy drink than a shake to me. Either way, let's get rolling. What does Mark hope we take away from today's chat?
In every sense of the word or the phrase, like the world is yours. It's what you make it. And so if they are stuck in a rut, if they are confused, if they are not knowledgeable, if they are just, you know, a little bit weary of like taking action, I hope that what they get out of this podcast and this interview and our story is that you can do anything you want with your life. It's about focusing your efforts, your time, your creativity, and your energy in certain directions. So I think, like, again, succinctly to say, I hope that people get out of this, that this world is yours. You can do whatever you want in it, and you don't have to play by anybody else's rules. As long as you don't murder people, you're okay.
Sounds similar to the message from the last guest, Jonathan Kendall, in episode 10, in which he talks about extreme ownership. So where does this sense of constructive accountability come from?
I was blessed, and I am blessed. I had a great upbringing. My parents are without a doubt the greatest parents on the planet. We have a great family. And so my mom and dad, my dad's from the East Coast. He's from Brooklyn. He's first generation here. Immigrant father came from Hungary, Romania, right on the border, came to Brooklyn. And actually my grandfather was one of seven. And when they were coming over, immigrating from Europe to America, my grandfather got sick. And so they left him behind, like at the age of 13. They're like, hey, you just stay here in Sziget, Romania. You just stay here. When you get better, you come find us in Brooklyn, New York. And so literally he stayed with the landlord for 2 years until he was healthy enough. And then he found his way to America, found his family. And, you know, that's where my grandfather grew up. Now, I never met him. He died before I was born. But again, I think kind of like that kind of like Gary Vee story of immigration and hustle and like what's in your DNA, there's a lot of that in the Hands family. And so my father is from Brooklyn and moved to Connecticut, but came to Illinois. Like when he graduated high school, his parents were like, hey, you're going to college in Peoria, Illinois, in the middle of nowhere. Here's your train ticket. Like, you leave in 2 weeks, go. And so he just got on a train and he went to Illinois. And my mom was a Chicagoan through and through, born and raised in Chicago for a few generations. And she was at the same college, and that's where my parents met. You know, the story my dad tells is that first my mom kind of blew him off, but eventually, like, they started dating. And when he came back to Chicago, he came to Chicago to meet my mom's family. And he saw my grandparents on my mom's side, like, interacting and hugging and holding hands at the dinner table. My dad had never really seen that. And he just kind of clicked in his head. He says that he knew that's what he wanted for his family. And it was like kind of like that moment that he's like, oh, my God, this is the woman for me. That's what I want in my life. And my dad has really just made his life's work, not just to, like, build small business and raise a great family, but to be, like, a great partner. And so, like, I grew up seeing my parents as a great partnership.
And as you'll come to see, the partnership of his parents and the impact of his father carries on through his works today.
the biggest thing that I really have learned from my parents is about helping other people. They run a chain of a small family business, and they're all throughout the city here in Chicago, and they're in some lower served communities. And my dad has always led the charge about giving back to the community, helping his employees out, really not just being a boss or a business owner, but really, really being a family leader for people in his extended, you know, like the Hawaiians say, ohana. And so to me, like growing up, I observed that. I felt that, you know, like when I was a little kid, my mom would pick me up at school. I'd go down to the currency exchange down in the city, and I'd sit behind the bulletproof glass, and Rose, you know, who was at the time like a 40-year-old Puerto Rican woman, would help me count change, and I'd hand out stamps. And I just grew up, again, not only learning to help people, but learning like that there's no boundaries on like race, culture, creed, religion, etc. And so I really, and I don't know how, but embedded in me was just this idea that like kind of we're all the same. So growing up, there was a lot of that, right? There was just a lot of like cultural diversity. There was a lot of work. My parents worked tirelessly. I dreaded the day the fax machine came to our house because that meant that we never ate a family meal without hearing like, and it was just always work. You know, work was always happening, but my parents always made time, no matter how busy they were, you know, to take me to a baseball practice or to make time for our family days. And so that's what growing up for me was like. I try to emulate my parents', you know, relationship. I try to emulate their hustle. I just try to do it in maybe perhaps a different fashion. I'll be honest, I think that in me, I always want to make them proud. Nothing to me is more important than like a reaffirming like pat on the back from my dad, my mom, or like just hearing them, you know, talk about me like I'm a little bitch like that. I want that affirmation, and that kind of drives me is to make sure that I'm doing them right. I don't want them to think their son is a schmuck.
Although I can't attest to Mark being a little bitch, you realize that he is anything but a schmuck. Although there was this one incident when, wait, I'm going to introduce that story a little bit later. So he had a great childhood, but like any other upbringing, there were some major hurdles to overcome.
So having said that all I want to do is make my parents proud, and learning from them about the hustle and the work and the kindness and the gratitude and helping other people, that's not to say that like growing up was all rainbows, puppy dogs, and ice cream. For me, there was massive challenge growing up, and that took the place of school, learning, and authority. And so I'll be honest, I've thought about this tremendously. I know that I struggled academically as a child, right? So I remember specifically, I was in Miss Robinson's third grade reading class, and I received my first D as a grade. And as soon as I got that D, it was almost like the Hulk went off inside me, that Bruce Banner, you know, Hulk thing, where I just got this D, and I kind of was like, fuck you, because like I'm a good kid, and I'm like making people happy, and I'm not causing any problems, like, why do I get this D? And like now looking back, and it's like, oh, because I couldn't fucking read so well, and I wasn't good at math, and I was getting bad grades. Like, that's what grades and learning are, right? Like, can you do these things? And so like at that young age, at like third grade, I just struggled. Like, I wasn't good at school. I wasn't like understanding the things. And for a person like me, who already kind of observed again, like this hustle, this work, this entrepreneurship from my brother, etc., I kind of like just took this different path where I was like, fuck this sucks. And I just didn't like school. I liked going to school. I loved talking to my friends. I loved recess. I loved art. But I mean, really from like kind of third grade on, I'm like, dude, I'm a 40-year-old man looking back at like third grade, right? This is like some therapy shit. But looking back on that, like that really was the time where I was like kind of first had this, you know, kind of kindling of like, oh, things don't have to be the same for everybody, right? Just because like the other 30 kids in the class were learning and I wasn't, like that wasn't bad. I just needed more help. But I kind of at the time was like, again, I kind of just in my head stuck up the middle finger and was like, oh, well, if I can't learn, I'm going to have fun. And so, again, that really started this just long, kind of arduous, you know, years and years and years of my parents getting called into school, me not doing my homework, me getting in trouble, like getting in the back of the class, like all of that. And so I kind of like say that I was a shitty student. It didn't come easy for me. And my parents are angels. They got me tutors. They sat with me. They worked with me. I mean, I'm a parent now, so looking back on this, I know it wasn't easy for them, and I give them so much props and respect and love and gratitude for what they must have gone through and that they're still believing in me. But yeah, school was just hard for me. My mom tells this great story that she got called into the principal's office one day, and she gets to school, and I'm sitting across from the principal's desk, and he says, "Oh, Mrs. Hamm, come in, sit down. Nice to see you again." Now, remember, I'm the youngest of three, so he knows my family because he knows my two older brothers who are really good kids. And he says, "Oh, Mark is here. Mark has something he wants to tell you. Mark, why don't you tell your mother the advice you gave the teachers and I?" And so I kind of just matter-of-factly said, "I thought it was bullshit that the teachers all assign all this homework every night. They should get their shit together, and they should say, hey, Monday night, you only do math. Tuesday night, you do your reading. Wednesday night, you do this." And I said, "It's not fair to us that you guys are putting all this work on us. Like, you guys should get your shit together." And so even at that young age, I was trying to hack the system, trying to, like, figure out a different way to do things to achieve the same end. And obviously that conversation didn't end well, and my parents weren't so happy with me then. And that just continued.
Just imagine your kid saying that. It's classically bold and horrifying all at once. It's also so telling of Mark's perspective. So although Mark was a good kid, his early educational experiences weren't his shining moments.
That shit just followed me through high school even. And it really wasn't until I got to college that my dad sat me down and was like, "Listen, like, what do you think you want to do? Like, you know, Mark, like, you're good at a lot of things. Like, why don't you be a teacher?" He's like, "You love," like, at the time in high school, my dad basically was like, "You know, you're basically like a big kid. You're never going to fucking sit behind a desk in an office. Be a fucking teacher, man. Like, you can inspire kids. Like, you can, like, kind of right the wrong that you felt you were dealt in school. Like, you could be the teacher that you needed for all the kids that are like you that are out there." And, like, at that moment, it just clicked for me. I was like, "Fuck yeah, dude, I'm going to be a teacher. I'm going to be, like, a radical, radical teacher." And so I started my journey to become, like, a public school teacher.
There's the powerful partnership with his father again. But before we get to that part of Mark's journey, we have some unfinished business. Remember Mark saying, "I don't want them to think that their son is a schmuck"? And I said that there's an incident in school that we talk about a little bit later. Well, it's later. Buckle up.
When I was in the sixth grade in junior high, they make you take Spanish. And my Spanish teacher and I, we just did not like each other. It wasn't like we didn't see eye to eye. It wasn't like we didn't get along. Like, there was, like, a legitimate arch rival nemesis relationship there. And so all year long, I get sent to the office, detention, my parents get called in, sitting in the back of the room, this and that. I mean, it was a game I would almost play. Like, how could I piss her off and see how far I could push this woman? And so I remember one day in particular, she's like, "Mark, this is enough. Take this desk, go to the back corner of the room." And so I'm all alone. I'm in the back corner of the room. All my friends are in their regular seats. And I continue to, like, try to talk to my buddies. So she comes over and she takes, like, a little AV cart with, like, an overhead projector, and she just pushes it in front of me. So, like, I can't see my friends. And then I kind of, like, am peeking around, like, "Hey, what's up, guys? What's up?" You know? And then she's like, "Mark, that's enough." So now she comes over and she literally moves a bookcase and she corners me into the corner. She, like, boxes me into the corner. So, like, I'm in a fucking cage. And I was like, "Oh my God, this is it. This is the final straw." So fast forward a few weeks, it's going to be the last day of school. We have a big field day at the school, right, where kids just go out and play games. And as I'm running to catch the bus, I have to run downstairs to my parents' house to pick something up. And I pass by this old Tupperware container my mom has where she keeps old greeting cards. And it's just like, as I'm passing by, a card catches my eye, and it's a little greeting card. It has a pressed set of woman's red lipstick lips, like a kiss on it, and it says, "Kiss another year goodbye." It was a birthday card. So I see it, something goes off in my head, I grab the card, I run out and grab my backpack, and I get on the bus. And when I get on the bus, I see this card. It says, "Kiss another year goodbye," with a set of lips on it, and the inside is blank. And I decide, in my terribly troubled, adolescent, hormonally infused, angst mind, that this is my moment to show this woman that I win. And so I take out my pen, and I do my best to mask my handwriting. So I write in, like, a different handwriting. And so on the front where it says kiss another year goodbye, I write bitch underneath it. And then on the inside, I write the most horribly offensive note that I can think of to this woman to tell her what I think she is and what she can go do to herself. And I write it, I put it in an envelope, and all my friends are like, no way, man, you're not going to give her that. I'm like, oh, fuck yeah, I'm going to give her this, and I'm going to show her. So we get to class that day, and I'll never forget, man. The room is, like, bare, right? It's, like, kind of like the last day of school, so she's checking books in. Like, the walls are bare. There's really nothing going on. And they're like, dude, are you going to give it to her? I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to fucking give her that card. And so at one point, she gets up. She's like, boys and girls, I got to go to the bathroom. I'll be right back. She gets up. And as soon as she gets up, she goes out of the room. I run up to the front of the classroom, and there's a stack of books that she's, like, checking in. And I take the card, and I kind of, like, wedge it into the stack of the books, and it's sticking out a bit. And I'm like, she'll find it. She just won't find it, like, when I'm in the room. And so I run back to my seat, and everyone's like, oh, my God, oh, my God. And then a buddy of mine is like, she's not going to see it there. And he runs up. He grabs the card, throws it on her desk. There's nothing else on her desk. Nothing except this white envelope with the card in it. And I'm like, oh, shit, this is really bad. And before I could even get up, she walks back in the room. She sees the card. She looks at the class with this smile as like to say, you shouldn't have. Who got me this? This is so sweet of you. You know, she's kind of blushing. She walks over to the card. I'm in my head. I'm hearing like, dun, 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 dun. You know, I'm hearing, like, the Darth Vader music. And I watch her, like, in slow motion. I'm, like, fucking Fred Savage in the Wonder Years watching this, right? She picks it up. She opens it up. Her face goes from sheer joy to sheer terror. She reads the card, looks up directly at me, and I just put, I'm like, oh! I divert my attention. I look somewhere else. She calmly puts the card down, goes back to work. A few minutes pass, the bell rings. Boys and girls, have a wonderful, wonderful summer. Mark hands, say after class. I immediately jump up. I'm like, I didn't do anything. And I run. I just run out of class. I run straight down to the office. So basically, to summate the story, they sit me down. And it's the teacher, myself, the social worker, the principal, all these other people. And I'm like, guys, I'll do whatever you want. Don't tell my parents. Please don't tell my parents. And they're like, oh, we're going to tell your parents. And all of a sudden, I remember the principal looks at me and goes, listen, man, I know your mom and dad. I know your brothers. They're good kids. I kind of think you're a good kid. I'm retiring. It's like my last day, or it's my last, you know, week or whatever of school. Here's what I'm going to do. I won't tell your parents, but tomorrow you come to school and you just sit in school suspension all day. I won't tell your parents. I'm like, deal. So what's this? 15 years later, I'm graduating from college, getting my degree in elementary education. I got my cap and gown. The parents come down. We're sitting around the table at a restaurant in college. And, you know, my dad goes to make a toast. He says, Mark, you know, we never thought you would get here, but now you're going to make us all proud. You're going to be a teacher. And then I said, yeah, who would have thought I would have become a teacher after that whole thing, you know, in sixth grade Spanish, that note that I wrote to Mrs. So-and-so. My mom and dad are like, what note? That guy, that principal, held his word. He never told my parents. And it wasn't until I graduated with my degree, my teaching certificate, and I'm about to become a teacher, that my parents finally heard that story. And if I could tell you that their faces went white when they heard the story and their hands, you know, just clasped their head, man, that was something I will never forget.
Damn. Mark did a really good job there vividly replaying that moment. You know how in Back to the Future, Doc warns Marty not to alter anything in the past because the ripple effect it may have in the future? I think this is one moment in Mark's life that he shouldn't undo, even if he could go back in a DeLorean. Yes, it was mean as fuck to Mrs. So-and-so, but the learning experience it provided obviously left a lasting impression, and the long-term good that would come from it justifies the moment, at least in my opinion. All right, back to Mark's journey. He's done with college. Now what?
And in the back of my head, again, like, I had always spent so much time, like, in these underserved communities in Chicago that I knew that's where I wanted to go teach. Like, I knew that that's where I wanted to go. I'd spent so much time there in my parents' stores, interacting with the community, that I was like, I want to go to a school in a neighborhood that is, like, socioeconomically challenged, like, a poor neighborhood. That's where I want to teach. And so I did. I came back to Chicago after college, found a school that needed some help, and I just started teaching. You know, I was like young, white, Jewish kid wearing like khakis and like, you know, Vans skateboard shoes. And I was like one of the only like white people in the neighborhood, you know, and it was like predominantly Latino. Again, like a pretty rough neighborhood, lots of gangs, lots of violence, drugs, etc. And I just like made it my mission that I was going to lead these children, like really take them on as if they were my own and give them the greatest 1 hour of their day was going to be like in my class. And I was determined. And so, you know, again, like looking at how can I hack the system? How can I, you know, achieve the goals that need to be achieved, but maybe in a different creative, you know, way. That's really how I approach teaching. And so I just became a really, you know, like a good teacher. Like I built really good relationships with the kids. I think they saw that I had their best interest at heart. Like when there were like big gang fights outside the school, like I was that dude, you know, running down Fullerton Avenue, barreling through a crowd of like 20 dudes, just brawling just to break it up, you know, and going out into the neighborhood, you know, delivering food for the holidays, you know, making sure kids' parents, if there was just bad stuff happening at home, just advocating, you know, just everything that I could do to help them, give them the best opportunity they could. And so there became a point where I knew that there were like other opportunities to help me grow as well, right? Like I think if you want to help and be of service to people, you can't be static yourself. You have to continue to grow. You have to continue to challenge. My best friend Colin talks about how things wouldn't be fun if you couldn't get hurt, right? And that you should do something every day that scares you. And that's kind of like the mantra that kind of goes through my life is like, every day, man, you're trying something new.
Mark flipped the script with his troubled educational past and returned to make good for the kids who needed him the most. And how powerful is that quote? If you want to help and be of service to people, you can't be static yourself. You have to continue to grow. You have to continue to challenge. That shit's so true. All right, so now it's my turn to steal a quick word and tell why I went from not knowing Mark at all to having him as a guest so quickly. Well, if you go to markdhands.com and check out the Oh Also section of his resume, you'll see, screw it. I'll just let this next segment do the talking.
As a teacher, I was seeking out opportunities for me to like learn and grow. And there was this fellowship that was being offered through the University of Chicago and a nonprofit called Project Exploration. And it was a husband and wife team. The husband was this world-renowned paleontologist. So a paleontologist, obviously, a scientist who digs up dinosaur bones. And his wife was like a community activist, like an intellect and an academic. And so they started this nonprofit that was really charged with taking inner city teachers and kids and introducing them into the world of science. And so one of the things they did was they would take 8 Chicago public school teachers each year and they would award them a fellowship. And the fellowship was a 3-week fellowship. So 1 week you would go to the University of Chicago to this doctor's, you know, again, world famous paleontology lab where you're surrounded. It was like Indiana Jones. You're like surrounded by like just literally dinosaurs, like dinosaur bones, microscopes and fossils and bones and fragments. And it was insane. And so it was literally like, I got like almost like a PhD in paleontology in 1 week. Like I worked with the Michael Jordan of dinosaurs. And after that, you pack your gear up, you get on a plane with this team and you fly to the middle of nowhere in Montana. You're out there for a week doing field work at a legit paleontology site. And we are like digging up fucking dinosaur bones. And so for me, like a kid, like a Chicago kid, that like I'm always used to being surrounded by cars and trains and buildings and buses and sounds and peoples and trees, to go out to the middle of nowhere, like the badlands of Montana, where you can't see life for anywhere you look. It's just like the badlands. It was a little bit of like a mind fuck, but I loved it. I was so excited. We legitimately dug up the Triceratops, right? We found like a good, like about an 80% portion of an articulated Triceratops, you know, like its leg, its head, its horn, its frill. Like we found it. It was crazy.
See, dig up a Triceratops and you're in. It's my party. I'll invite who I want. How did this epic experience perpetuate the thought of bettering himself for the benefit of those he wanted to serve?
I was just so excited about like this crazy opportunity I was in the middle of. Here's a kid, again, there was no shot that I was going to be anything academic. And here I am now, I'm a teacher. I'm out here with a team of world-renowned scientists digging up dinosaurs in the middle of Montana, and I'm just so excited that I kind of like, my fist was just like clenched, and I was always like kind of pumping my fist throughout the mornings. I'm like, dude, let's go. You know, like we'd wake up at like 5 a.m., get some shitty coffee, throw down some eggs, and we'd be out in the field by like 6 a.m. before it got way too hot. And I'm like, come on, man, let's wake up. Let's go, guys. And everyone's like, man, motherfucker, calm down, Mark. And so finally, like on day three, one of the guys turns to me and he's like, hey, what's with you, man? He's like, what's with, you're always pumping your fist. What's the matter with you? And I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm like, I'm just so excited. You know, like this is my science fist. And everyone laughed like, oh, a science fist, really? And like that became like a little inside joke that this was like a thing. It was like, you know, when we go find something new, like, oh, sweet, science fist. And so, you know, fast forward a few weeks later, I come back to Chicago. I'm starting up teaching again for the new year. And in my head, like, the science fist thing is just kind of brewing. It's like this call to action. Like, I thought my students would dig it, you know? And so I made, like, little science fist signs and put them around my classroom. And, like, I was explaining to the kids, this is what science is about. This is what life is about. It's living with passion and getting so excited that when you discover something new, when you are you know, on the journey and you're just so stoked about something, it's like you pump your fist, it's your science fist. And at the time, I was getting a master's degree at the Illinois Institute of Technology. What I like to tell people is it's like the MIT of the Midwest. I'll never forget when I got my acceptance letter to this university for the master's program. It says, congratulations, Mark. You are joining the ranks of, you know, 11 Nobel laureates and the woman that discovered the hole in the ozone layer and, you know, the creator of the microchip processor. You'll be joining the ranks of all these great scientific minds. And I read it, I was like, holy shit, how did I get into this thing, you know? And so anyway, when I was getting my degree, I was in a small cohort of teachers, and I was telling them about science fist, and like, oh my God, they're like, dude, that's so awesome. And I was like, oh, you like it too? And so a buddy of mine, my friend Melissa, makes like t-shirts. I was like, hey, I need some t-shirts. So I, you know, went on Google Images, I got like a picture of a fist, and I got a picture of like an atom, you know, a molecule, and I overlaid them in Google Images, and I said, here, make me shirts that say this, and I want to say science fist underneath it. And I literally started selling science fist shirts out of my car, the trunk of my car on the south side of Chicago after my master's classes. And then finally, my best friend Colin, again, my skateboarding buddy, like my best friend, was like, dude, you got something here, man. Like, why don't we do something with it? He's like, I'm like, well, what are we going to do? He's like, I don't know. He's like, but he's like, oh, you got all these kids, you know, on the west side of Chicago. They're all excited about science. We should give that to more kids. And so we kind of brainstormed. And what really happened was, again, like I'm a schmoozer by DNA. I'm a hustler and a schmoozer and a grinder. And so I'd always been networking. And so at like one end of my network, I had all these schools and these teachers that I knew and these principals. And they kind of really wanted to get like really good science into their school. And on the other end of my network, I've just been networking with people at like really great companies like Dyson and Google and Motorola, and working with people at like museums that are trying to get into schools. And I kind of looked at it and saw an opportunity to say, hey, like all these companies want to give back to communities, and all these communities want to get engaged with these companies. I can be the conduit. So I created a nonprofit. It was called the Science Fist Foundation. And what the Science Fist Foundation originally did was it linked up programs and companies that I would vet and say, hey, these are legit companies that are really going to do good for your kids. And I'd link them up with schools to say, hey, you want a biologist in your classroom? Sweet. You go talk to Gary. Gary's the biologist. He's going to come in. Or, oh, you want your kids building robots? I got the people at the Museum of Science and Industry. They'll come to your school and run a program. So that's how it started. It was like matchmaking.
From making a fist while drinking shitty coffee in the middle of Montana to starting a really purposeful nonprofit, the trajectory of the story only gets better.
Around that time, IDEO, the world-famous design thinking and innovation firm, released something called Design Thinking for Educators. It was like a 15-page PDF, and I just kind of happened upon it one day online. And when I read it, you know, it was like one of those like holy moments where like the pages glow and everything fades to black in the background, and you hear like, oh, I was like, holy shit, man. Like, so at that point, I got so into it. I started reading everything I could about design thinking and the Kelly Brothers and IDEO. I started practicing it and applying design thinking to my life. And then I realized that design thinking and really innovation in general is just about the idea of finding a need, a really true empathetic need that people have, in designing a solution around that need versus like building a product or a service and then trying to cram it down people's throats. It's more like, no. Really, what do people need from an empathetic viewpoint and develop it? And I knew that the kids that I was serving in all these communities now through my foundation, they had really big problems, bigger than I had, right? They're dealing with gun violence. They're dealing with absent parents. They're dealing with, you know, drugs. They're dealing with big, big issues. And so I flipped the foundation and I designed a 12-week design challenge where the students would get paired with a mentor from one of these like innovative companies like Dyson or Motorola or whatever. And they would go through a 12-week design challenge, a design thinking challenge, to find a problem in their life or in their neighborhood, work with their mentor to develop a solution. And then at the end, we'd have like this big showcase where we'd all just share these ideas. And so that Science Fist Foundation, and again, really, which all started from this whole dinosaur dig thing, really just like kind of propelled me into like a lot of different areas. And so at that point, like I won this teaching award. There's like this really prestigious teaching award they give in Illinois. It's called the Golden Apple. And part of the award is you get like a cash prize, but they also pay for you to leave teaching for a semester. And what they do is they pay for you to go to Northwestern University, all expenses paid, and you can take any classes you want. I was like, well, I'm really interested in like entrepreneurship and like innovation. And Northwestern University houses the Kellogg School of Management, which is like a really, you know, it's kind of like a top-notch executive education program where people from some of the biggest companies in the world fly from around the world to come to do this program. And so I said, hey, let me ask you something, man. If I could take classes in Northwestern, can I just take classes at Kellogg? And they're like, I don't know. In the 20 years we've done this, nobody's asked. I'm like, well, let's figure that out. And so sure enough, they said, yeah, listen, well, let's just take some classes at Kellogg. So I went and I took like 3 or 4 courses. I'm sitting there with CEOs of huge companies, you know, and I just started like eating that up and like really learning, growing, kind of, again, trying to hack that system. How do I find my way into these classes? How can I use this information to help other people? And then again, like at this point in my life, somebody reached out to me and said, hey, listen, I got an opportunity. I need a guy like you with a lot of passion, a lot of energy, somebody that's not scared to break things and blow things up. I want you to come work for our school district. I want you to completely rewrite our science curriculum for basically like 40,000 kids. We want you to be the science guy. You kind of do what you want, right? Take it over, make it new and innovative. And I was like, sweet. So I had gone from, you know, being a teacher and having my foundation impacting, you know, hundreds of kids. Now I'm in a position where I have the opportunity to impact like tens of thousands of kids, like 40-something thousand kids. And so I took that job and I became like a curriculum designer. Now I'm like, again, applying design thinking and these innovative strategies to like new opportunities to develop new curriculum and opportunities for kids and teachers. And I just really got into that, man. And that really kind of excited me again, where now I wasn't teaching kids, but I was teaching teachers how to teach kids. And that was really exciting to me.
So where are we now? Good family and childhood to shitty student, to motivated teacher, to dinosaur hunter and science fist, now educational influencer. Not too shabby. Socrates once said, the hard worker with their nose to the grindstone will remain a hard worker, but the hard worker with their eyes focused on purpose will become a leader. That definitely rings true here, even if I did just make up that quote. Marcus had the work ethic and recognized the opportunities to put himself in the position to lead and finally hit his full stride. Listen up.
And what I realized is that what I was good at and what drove me was not just teaching what we would call content, right? Like, or skill necessarily. Because those are like two important things. It's like, what do you know and what can you do? But what I was really excited me was when I would inspire people to just think differently, right? These are like teachers that have been teaching since we used like an abacus and chalk, you know? Now we got like these digital whiteboards and iPads, like, in helping them transition their mindset to say, hey, like, there's a different way to look at the world. There's a different way to think about this. And if we can change the way we look at the world, then we can change the behaviors and how we act within the world, and then we can change the outcomes of the world. And that, like, just lit a fucking fire under me, man. And so that's what I'm doing now. Like, that really, that's kind of my story, is, like, I had this foundation of good love, good support from my family of just hardworking, good people. And even though I had immense struggles as a kid academically and in school, like they supported me, they loved me, they let me know it was okay to be a little bit different. I kind of had to like struggle through those adolescent and high school years, you know, and get through that until I had this moment of clarity of like, oh shit, I can help others. There's other people like me. I can help them. I could be the leader for them. And then pivoted that to kind of like hacking the system, finding new opportunities, and then again, hacking the system again and being like, wait a minute, like I just don't need to teach people stuff and skills. I can literally give them a new set of eyes to look at the world and see the world just as like a canvas of opportunity to recreate and redesign and not be scared of failure. And so that's what I do now, man. Like that's literally what I do is some days I'm at a coffee shop with a woman who's been working in corporate America, who is like a high level C-level executive. And it's like, what am I doing with my life? And I can help her see the world differently. And other days I'm giving design thinking workshops to like Fortune 50 companies about innovation and design. And other times I'm just on Instagram trying to connect with everybody I can and preach some goodness and inspire them to think differently.
That sense of purpose mixed with passion is what will continue to propel Mark forward. To wrap things up, I asked Mark for any parting words of wisdom that he learned from his experiences.
You know, I kind of try to look at life in terms of what do things look like 4 days from now, 4 months from now, and 4 years from now. And the one thing that I always think success will look like for me is that whether I'm looking 4 days, 4 months, or 4 years from now, that that's always going to be different. I'm always going to be a little bit different. And so that's what I'm trying to help people figure out, man. Is like, don't fall into the system that we've always had. The world's changing at a rapid pace. And either you're running with the pack, you're leading the pack, or you just got trampled by the pack. And I don't like seeing people get trampled. What I like to say, man, is I'll always fight for the underdog because I am the underdog. And if you're not falling and you're not failing along the way in life and exercise and business, if you're not falling and failing, you're not doing it right. Nothing good should be easy. It's like an old Irish quote. I heard it in like a flogging Molly song. It says, nothing ever came from a life that was a simple one.
I bet you didn't plan on learning anything from flogging Molly today. So to sum things up from our chat with Mark, own your outcome, position yourself for the opportunity through hustle and self-awareness, don't be afraid to purposely fail, and finally, seek a higher purpose that excites the fuck out of you in a real and sustainable way. I hope you enjoyed listening to Mark as much as I loved interviewing him. Now go out there, make your science fist, and get shit done. This episode of I Digress Podcast is produced by Matthew Pietrakowski, music by Nuts. I'm Arul Chanel. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes and like us on SoundCloud. It would really help. It's fun time.